All right, now that we have the technical difficulties squared away, good afternoon. Welcome to today's Thomas C. Sorensen Seminar Series event featuring Senator Deb Fischer. I'm Nancy Shank. I'm the Acting Director of the University of Nebraska Public Policy Center, and the center has been sponsoring these seminar series for the last 15 years as part of our mission to link service, outreach, and research to university staff and faculty. The seminar series is an opportunity for us to invite decision makers, policy makers, and researchers to campus to present firsthand what's happening in important policy issues. This afternoon, as well as in past events, we will have the opportunity for questions of the senator after her remarks. So please be thinking about questions that you may want to ask her. And then also following the event, we'll have time for some media interviews. And I think we'll just plan for the media to gather up here in the room, and that will be your opportunity to visit with the senator. The Thomas C. Sorensen Public Policy Seminar Series is supported by the Thomas C. Sorensen Endowment that is to the University of Nebraska College of Arts and Sciences. And thanks to the College of Arts and Sciences for their continued support of this series. There are also a number of co-sponsors to this afternoon's event, including the Association of Students of the University of Nebraska, and Aaron Cooper, Government Liaison, and Kevin Knutson, now past student body president, is that right? Thank you for your support. The Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at UNL, Dee Aguilar, coordinator. The UNL Center for Civic Engagement, thanks to Linda Major, the director. The University of Nebraska College of Law, thanks to Amber Wolf for arranging this, and she is the head of marketing and digital strategy. And the UNL Department of Political Science, thanks to Kevin Smith. I'd also like to acknowledge the assistance of Carrie Jackson with the Nebraska Unions, Caitlin Holman, College Republicans. Caitlin must be here in the second row. Thank you, Caitlin. And also Tariq Abdul-Menem, who is part of the University of Nebraska Public Policy Center, and he has been coordinating these seminar series for the past 15 years. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Kevin Smith, who chairs the Political Science Department in the College of Arts and Sciences here at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And Kevin also has the distinction of having been a policy seminar series presenter in the past. Thanks.
Thank you, Nancy. I am Kevin Smith, the chair of the Poli Sci department here. And it's my pleasure today, my pleasure and my duty, to introduce two native Nebraskans who have directly and indirectly made today's event possible. The first of these Nebraskans is Thomas C. Sorensen, who was a 1947 graduate of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And when he left, he went on to have a 50-year career in journalism, in government, and the financial industry. In all of these roles, he was known for his expertise in the Middle East, and among other things, he served as Deputy Director for the United States Information Agency, Vice President of the University of California. He was a Deputy Manager of John F. Kennedy's presidential run in 1960 in California. And for the last decade and a half of his career, he was an analyst and an advisor for the Capital Group companies of Los Angeles, one of the biggest and largest investment management firms in the nation. What we most remember Tom for these days, though, is as a philanthropist. And it is through his generosity that today's event is possible. Though he spent most of his career working outside of Nebraska, he never forgot his Nebraska roots or his alma mater. And he wanted to create a lasting legacy that would promote civic engagement and participation in his home state. So in 1996, just a year before he passed away, Tom created an endowment. And he created that endowment with the understanding that its income would support educational activities to help promote discussion of policy issues among Nebraskans. That endowment supports the Thomas C. Sorensen Public Policy Seminar Series that Nancy mentioned, which seeks to achieve those objectives by bringing in speakers of national stature and importance. We are tremendously grateful to Tom's generosity and wanted to publicly acknowledge that. I also get to introduce another native Nebraskan, who is also a graduate of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln twice over, once as an undergraduate and once with his JD, and is the 19th chancellor of the university. He is, without a doubt, in the very first rank of those who have led this institution. During his tenure, UNL has grown in enrollment. It has increased its scholarly and academic reputation nationally and internationally. It has globalized its educational operations, and it has nearly doubled its research expenditures. Perhaps most impressively, his biggest accomplishment is creating a series of short videos that have turned him into something of a social media star, and some of you may be familiar with Pearls of Knowledge. Among other things, this has given us a fascinating insight into what a world-class leader of a university thinks. And based on my close analysis of these videos, it appears that such people think that snow days are bad, smiling is mentally healthy, and YOLO as a catchphrase is stupid. For 14 years, he has been leading this institution with sagacity, with wisdom, and his own unique sense of humor. He recently announced, perhaps to his relief, but certainly to our regret, that he would serve only one more year in this position. We still have him for another year, though, so rest assured that we intend to ensure that he keeps on laboring hard in the administrative salt mines. So rather than sing his praises even more, let's put him to work. Ladies and gentlemen, Harvey Perlman.
Well, I've learned one of the consequences of announcing retirement early is you get to hear people say nice things about you and you don't have to die to have that happen. But good afternoon. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this event, which is part of the Thomas C. Sorensen Public Policy Seminar Series. It's my honor to introduce Senator Deb Fischer, whose lecture title today is U.S. Foreign Policy, A View from the Senate. Senator Fischer is a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, chair of the Subcommittee on Emerging Threats and Capabilities. She is a lifelong Nebraskan, is a senior senator from Nebraska, being elected to the U.S. Senate in 2012. Senator Fischer believes the first duty of Congress is to defend the nation. As a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, she is committed to neutralizing growing threats to our homeland and our allies. In her capacity as chairman of the Senate Armed Services Subcommittee on Emerging Threats, she is focused on working with our military to monitor the threats facing our nation and provide the appropriate tools for them to meet these challenges. This subcommittee's jurisdiction includes cybersecurity policy. Fischer also serves on the Senate's Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee as chair of the Subcommittee on Surface Transportation and Merchant Marine Infrastructure Safety and Security, Committee on Environment and Public Works, and the Committee on Small Business and Entrepreneurship, and is a member of the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's leadership team, serving as counsel to the Majority Leader, as well as a member of the Senator John Cornyn's whip team. Before her election to the U.S. Senate, Senator Fischer served in the Nebraska unicameral, representing the 43rd Legislative District since 2004. During her time in the state legislature, she also is a member of the Revenue Committee, Natural Resources Committee, and the Executive Board. She also is a graduate of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, graduating with a degree in education. I can tell you from experience working with her in the legislature, she is an intense interrogator with regard to social policy, but also was a strong supporter of the University of Nebraska. So please welcome to the podium Senator Deb Fischer.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Chancellor, for those very kind words. I would like to add my thanks to you for leading this institution, being a wonderful representative of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and also for the state of Nebraska. So thank you, sir. And I would like to thank the sponsors of this event and all of you who are attending. We have a full house today, so thank you very much for being here. I would like to begin my remarks with a question, and it's a question that I am very often asked, and that is, what is the greatest threat to our nation? Well, we have no shortage of choices, sadly, and while I do have a very clear answer to that question, I would first like to set the scene by explaining some of the key hotspots that we have around the world and the challenges that they each pose to our nation, but also to our allies. So let's start with Russia. Many of you who grew up in my generation remember the days of the nuclear arms races that we had with the Soviet Union. And all of us hoped that we would see peace, we would see security after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that we would have a more peaceful era where the Russian people would see peace, but also Russia's democratic neighbors would see peace. Unfortunately, time has proven that that was wishful thinking. Russia is now fighting a proxy war in the Ukraine, and they are menacing our NATO allies. Meanwhile, China is a stubbornly communist nation, and they are becoming increasingly belligerent toward their neighbors. The Chinese are actually constructing artificial islands in the South China Sea so that they can press their territorial claims in that area. The Middle East is engulfed in conflict. In Syria, we have seen approximately 220,000 people killed. Over 10 million people have been displaced in their 4 years of civil war. The president's red line in the sand has faded. I questioned his lack of strategy at the time, and now this ambivalence has, I believe, emboldened our enemies and really frightened our allies. So this regional instability gave rise to the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, which is known as ISIL. They have seized Iraq's second largest city, Mosul, and much of the country. So while the United States has built coalitions to attack ISIL targets in Iraq and in Syria, this has only slowed the advance. And this group continues to seize territory. As the recent offensive of the ISIL-held city of Dikirk makes it very, very clear, the Iraqi army is struggling and having difficulty in trying to retake even the small cities under ISIL control. And the campaign to liberate Mosul, that's probably a long way off. The region's become further inflamed 2 weeks ago with the collapse of the Yemeni government at the hands of the Houthi rebels. In response to that Houthi advance, Saudi Arabia has formed a 10-nation coalition with its Gulf Arab allies, and they are conducting airstrikes against the Houthi forces. Conflict in the heart of the Middle East has also spilled over into North Africa. Many fighters from Syria have returned to Libya and established an ISIL presence in the area of Derna. And they and other hardline extremists have taken advantage of the lack of a central government in Libya to carve out that territory for themselves. This has the potential to become a significant security threat. And as General Rodriguez, who is the commander of the U.S. African Command, recently testified to Congress, he noted that Libya is emerging as a safe haven where terrorists, including Al-Qaeda and Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant-affiliated groups, can train and rebuild with impunity. the list doesn't end there. But the point is unmistakable. These are dangerous times. New challenges spring up for us, and the old ones don't seem to go away. It's hard to blame those who argue that the United States, that we should withdraw, and that we should pursue a more limited diplomatic agenda. Oil prices are low. American energy is booming. There's economic opportunities in Asia. So why do we need to be involved in the Middle East? I think in addition to remembering the tragic deaths of those who were beheaded by ISIL fighters, Peter Kasich, Stephen Soltloff, James Foley, and the death of the American aid worker, Kayla Mueller, our nation must never forget the hard lessons that we've learned, that remote problems can rapidly follow us home, and they can do so, folks, very, very quickly. So let's consider the conflict in Syria. More than 18,000 foreign fighters have joined the conflict there. 3,000 come from Western nations, including the United States. This represents a tremendous security challenge for our European allies, whose Western citizens make up the majority of the fighters. Moreover, the active publicity campaigns that we see on Twitter and elsewhere in social media, they've inspired homegrown attacks, as we've seen in France and Belgium, in Canada and Australia. Our security interests are similarly at stake in Yemen. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is more commonly referred to as AQAP, has long been considered by security officials to be among the most serious terrorist threats to the West, particularly for their ability to plot attacks. They're very creative. AQAP was responsible for the attack on the USS Cole in the year 2000 and the so-called underwear bomber in 2009. It was also alleged to be behind a plot to bomb two cargo planes in transit by concealing explosive inside printer cartridges. In this incident, the bombs were reportedly discovered at stopovers, so they had already been transported on passenger and cargo planes. I don't believe that this violence will be thwarted by isolationist policies. Moreover, a diplomatic withdrawal won't decrease the threats that are posed to us or to our allies. Should the security of our partners in the Middle East be seriously threatened, the United States would be obligated to respond in a far greater way. And the same can also be said with respect to our NATO allies, who are particularly concerned about the terrorist threats from North Africa. I believe that we also have a strong humanitarian interest that really compels us to try and solve these conflicts. ISIL's campaign against ethnic and religious minorities, I think, should unite the civilized world in opposing their barbarity. And finally, we should realize that a further reduction in the United States' influence that provides gaps that other nations will step forward and fill. You know, that may not sound like a bad proposition at first, but it does carry significant risk. For example, Saudi Arabia recently began airstrikes in Yemen, and they only notified the United States, where we've been a longtime regional partner, They only notified us the day they began the attacks. Empowering our local partners often gives us less control over what they do, gives us less control over the action that they may take, and they're more likely to make their own decisions on where and how to fight. Second, the influence gap may be filled by a country that doesn't share our goals. And indeed, I believe the candidate most likely to fill that gap would be Iran. So while each of these threats is very, very grave, I don't believe that they can be viewed within a vacuum. And there is still a much greater threat out there. It's the threat that keeps me up at night, and that is the specter of a nuclear Iran. So this brings me back to my opening question. What is the greatest threat to the United States? Without a doubt, I believe the greatest threat to our country is a nuclear-armed Iran. Over the past several years, much of my attention has been focused on Iran's nuclear program, and much of the attention of the United States government has been focused on Iran's nuclear program. I'd like you to imagine for a moment what would be the consequences of a nuclear-armed Iran on global nuclear proliferation. We need to be extremely mindful that Iran's regional adversaries, such as Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Turkey, and Egypt, they will likely match Iran's ambition. In fact, in a recent interview, Prince Faisal, who is the former head of Saudi Arabia's intelligence service, acknowledged this concern. He stated, "I have always said whatever comes out of these talks, we will want the same. So if Iran has the ability to enrich uranium to whatever level, it's not just Saudi Arabia that's going to ask for that." What the prince is indirectly saying is that three or four rival programs, a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, it could be hanging in the balance of the negotiations that are taking place now. This underscores the importance of crafting a deal that our allies have faith in, one that deprives Iran of becoming a threshold nuclear power. While the framework agreement that was announced last week does not represent a binding commitment, I think there is good reason to question whether the parameters that are described by the White House meet that standard. First, important details are still unclear. For example, the White House has announced that inspectors will have regular access to all of Iran's nuclear facilities. So what does regular access mean? Is that once a week? Is it unlimited? At this time, we don't know. Which facilities would they be allowed access to? Will this include Iran's military facilities that are alleged to have been involved in their nuclear weapon development? That's unclear. The pace of sanction relief is also ambiguous. The White House has stated that sanctions will be suspended after Iran has taken all of its key nuclear-related steps, but they do not specify what these steps are. And even though this wording is vague, the Iranian leaders have already disputed the White House position, and they have stated that the verbal agreement was to provide Iran with sanctions relief as it implemented the deal, not after. We're told that negotiations will now begin to resolve the technical aspects of the framework, but these questions are not new. What this really means is that after over a year and a half of negotiations, the key points of the agreement are still remaining a disagreement. On top of that, it appears that the United States negotiators have accepted Iran's insistence that it retain all of its nuclear infrastructure, and not one of its sites will be closed. One of the broader criticisms of the negotiations is that it only focuses on Iran's nuclear program, as if the only thing we need to be concerned about is whether or not Iran will become a nuclear power. Iran's nuclear program is simply one path they have for achieving their goal of becoming a dominant regional power, but it is not the only one. Since their 1979 revolution, Iran has cultivated a network of terrorist groups throughout the Middle East that conduct operations in support of Iranian interests. And while these groups may often begin as criminal gangs or militia, many have grown into sophisticated terrorist systems. And they have a vast network that reaches into Latin America. So these terrorist organizations are playing key roles in each of the Middle Eastern conflicts that I have mentioned. For example, Iranian intervention likely saved Assad in 2013. In turn, this dictator continues to depend on Iranians' arms and assistance, as well as the muscle of Iran's Lebanon proxy, Hezbollah, to defend his regime. We know that in Yemen, the Houthi rebels have brought down the Yemeni government, and they have received not just training, but also weapons from Iran. At the same time, Iranian forces are on the ground in Iraq, and they are supporting the local Shia militia, who also receive weapons and assistance from Iran. Meanwhile, some are suggesting that Iran's intervention in Iraq, it could be a positive thing. After all, Iran opposes the Islamic State, so why not welcome their forces as the boots on the ground that we are looking for? But that's not true. Many of the problems that are in Iraq today are the result of sectarian tensions. And Iran's meddling, I think, will only amplify that situation. Indeed, as Tehran and Baghdad draw closer together, Iraq's chances of reconstituting their country as a unified country, not partitioned into three parts, that becomes less of a possibility. This expansion represents significant progress for Iran. So instead of covertly peddling their influence, the commander of Iran's Quds Force is on the ground and leading an offensive in Iraq. So Iran's not just shipping rockets to Gaza anymore. Four major Arab capitals are now under its sway: Damascus, Sana'a, Baghdad, and Beirut. Some suggest that a nuclear deal with Iran could help solve some of these problems. I disagree. Iran's regional ambitions, I think, will continue unabated. We've heard from the director of the National Intelligence, Jim Clapper, and he spoke to this question earlier this year when he stated that the Iranians have, quote, segmented the nuclear negotiations and potential nuclear agreement from their regional aspirations. In other words, even if the administration reaches some sort of nuclear agreement with Iran, the hardliners in Tehran, they're going to continue to explore ways that they can destabilize the area, that they can reach their regional ambitions. We can't rely solely on that radical shift to happen in Iran politics. And I think we must instead understand what Iran's goal is. And that goal is to build a regional power, and they will do so through these proxies. So that means that the short-term alliances that some may want, they're for convenience. And I think they should be out of the question, because we have to look at the long term. While maintaining its focus on Iran's abilities as a primary threat, I believe the administration must also address some of the more nuanced questions with regards to some of these questions. I'm concerned that there is confusion with Iran's role on how further it's harmed this administration's ability to craft and lead partner nations on a coherent strategy to help solve some of these regional problems. In Syria, for example, we're undertaking a program to train and equip the moderate rebels. We want to train them to fight ISIL, degrade and destroy. Well, this program is still in the initial stages. But even at full capacity, we are only looking at being able to train 5,400 of these moderates a year. And we're looking at ISIL strength at 30,000. So while it's not clear that this program is enough to achieve the president's goal of destroying ISIL, I am concerned about the president's failure to answer two key questions on Syria and on his strategy. First, at the tactical level, what is the president's plan for when a U.S.-trained fighters, what happens if they come into conflict with Assad's forces? We are investing American resources to train and equip these fighters. But they look at their main enemy to be Assad rather than ISIL. Second, at the strategic level, what is going to be our overall policy toward Assad? I think the inability to answer those two questions, that's driven some very deep divisions among our partners, most of whom strongly, strongly supported the president when he drew that red line in the sand. We recall those famous words, but the red line disappeared, and I think that was a key turning point in our nation and our nation's standing in the world. Our allies have argued really furiously for the president to follow up on those words, because they see Assad not just as a brutal dictator, but they see another proxy for Iran's ambitions. Our paralysis towards Assad, for fear that any action taken against him may cause disruption in the negotiations that we're having with Iran over their nuclear program, that needs to be resolved. Because the longer it festers, the more it's going to erode the larger diplomatic standing. And we can never forget that strategic confusion is a message that is broadcast to a global audience. Our partners and our allies take note. Our adversaries take note as well. Calling for Assad to leave without taking any action, that will influence the Russians, it will influence the North Koreans. It will influence Syria, it will influence Iran. The Middle East conflicts, they weren't of our making. And many of them are going to be beyond our ability to solve. But unless we have a clear strategy and strong leadership, we are going to be unable to exert any kind of influence, to build coalitions, or to reverse that trend that we are viewing in that area and around the world towards greater violence. So I think it's clear the world is a very dangerous place. We no longer have oceans to hide behind. The world is interconnected, and so are the threats that we face daily. This should not deter us as a country from taking bold leadership. The United States has long been the force for good, for the greatest good in the world. I believe we still can be. I think the best counter we have to aggression, that we have to belligerent nations, that we have to terrorists, is a robust American defense. The 20th century was known as the American century. We had the greatest generation. This was a generation that fought World War II, defeated Hitler, brought us peace and prosperity. We liberated the world. That generation set a high bar, but we can achieve it again. Yes, we live in a dangerous world. Yes, we face tremendous threats every day. But we need to start leading again. To do so, we have to have clear goals. We have to have a coherent strategy. To do so, we need to call out evil for what it is. And we need to have the wisdom and the courage to confront it. It's time to start showing some spine and making some hard choices, because the world is still counting on us. I hear that every time I meet with leaders from around the world. They are still counting on American leadership. We need to provide it. Thank you. I would be happy to answer any questions you may have. You may wake up now. Any questions? Yes. Could you stand? That's one of the question was what looking at the cost, what is the interest of the United States in keeping a unified Iraq? That's a great question, but it's also an important part of what the strategy is and what the goals are. You know, I talked about Syria and looking at what the goals are for the United States in Syria. If we're going to come together as a country and address the threats that face us as a country, I always say we have to have a strategy that all of us understand. And so that's why I question the administration, because it's the job of the president, of the commander-in-chief, to make these decisions. It's my job then to have oversight, to understand that strategy, and provide the resources needed for him to complete those missions. So when we look at Iraq, it's basically partitioned into three areas now. We need to be clear what the goal is. Is the goal to have a unified Iraq? That's what it's always been in the past. Is that our goal going forward? If we defeat ISIL in a third of the country that they occupy, what is the goal there? Who moves into that area? You know, and how will the United States be involved in that? Are we going to sit back and watch the proxies of Iran move into that area? So then basically you have two areas in Iraq with the Kurds and with the Shia militia controlling that area. So the question is, what's the goal? What's the end game on the strategy, not just in Iraq, but in Syria as well, once ISIL is defeated? Is the goal and strategy still to remove Assad from office? I don't know. I think that needs to be made clear. What is that strategy? If it's to remove Assad from office when ISIL is defeated in the territory that they control in Syria, how are we going to react to that? What is our next move? Do we move in there? Do we allow Assad to move in there? Nature doesn't like a vacuum. And someone or some country will move in to fill it. So when I'm talking about it in my comments here about goals and strategy, that's what I was referring to. We need to be clear on those. The president needs to express those so that we understand the mission, so that the American people understand what the mission is, and we can provide the resources necessary to accomplish that mission.
So, the United States is a world power, and the greatest threat that we have militarily is a regional power, our perspective for emergent regional power in a different continent. Does that ever make you feel like remarkably safe?
Iran isn't our only concern. You know, early in my comments, I mentioned Russia. I chose to focus on Iran because that's what keeps me up at night. Russia is a nuclear power. They are a threat with cybersecurity issues. The Chancellor said, I chair the subcommittee on armed services with emerging threats and capability. It deals with cybersecurity and counterterrorism. And Russia is definitely a threat to the United States. We're good at what we do. We are the best, but other countries are getting better. Russians are good, Chinese are good at what they do, and at another level you have the Iranians and the North Koreans. But there are powers and in nation states around the world that pose threats to us. It's not just a regional threat, again, with Iran. Iran has a program where they are developing ballistic missiles. They will have an ICBM within a year, probably. They're not a regional threat when they have an ICBM, because an ICBM reaches our homeland. And if they are allowed to become a nuclear power with nuclear weapons, They are a global threat, and they are a direct threat to the United States. So while we may look at them as a regional threat now to the bad neighborhood that they live in, their breakout time is a very short period when they can have nuclear weapons.
You mentioned a lot of different countries when we were talking about threats to America, and one that I noticed was not mentioned was Pakistan. Could you talk briefly about the threat that they might pose, as they are a nuclear nation right next to India and those tensions? Could you just talk briefly about that?
Sure. Pakistan is focused on India, and that is their biggest rival, biggest enemy. They're focused in that area. The biggest threat they have to our country is the threat of them selling nuclear weapons or selling material needed to build a nuclear weapon to other countries. If we see an arms race in the Middle East, if the Iranians are able to develop that nuclear weapon, if it's not stopped, there will be an arms race. The Saudis can afford to buy one. The UAE can afford to buy one. Turkey and Egypt are not going to stand by because they view Iran as the greatest threat that they have as well. Thank you.
Senator, you brought up cybersecurity. China as a possible threat. And recently we've seen that Chinese are not afraid government officials and government resources to not only attack the cybersecurity of American companies, but also defense companies. And we've also seen that the last fighter jet that they just started testing is largely based off American designs. We also know that the Chinese military is expanding its navy at a rapid rate. So at what point do we start a discussion with them or just trying to figure out what their defenses are? Because they're what they plan on doing with this larger military force?
The Chinese are increasing their military at a very fast rate. They are building submarines. What I referenced in my remarks was their designs in the South China Sea and how their neighbors are very, very concerned about what's going on there. If you look at a map, look at the South China Sea, and you can Google this and see what the Chinese have claimed. All of their neighbors in that area are worried. The Chinese are building islands to bolster those claims in the South China Sea. And I would say they're pushing those territorial claims for the minerals that are found in that area. The Chinese are a nation, as you all know, rapidly developing. They're good at cyber attacks. Right now, I would say their biggest threat would be in that area. But they will also not sit back if the United States tries to move in and become an arbitrator in there. So it's a very tense situation. They won't look kindly on the United States trying to protect some of our friends and allies in that area. So it'll be tense in negotiations with the Chinese. And they're testing rockets all the time too that can take out satellites. So they're big threats. Not in the same way that Iran and Russia could be. Yes.
So you mentioned at the end that one of the things that we have to do is acknowledge evil and badness to combat it. Does that involve acknowledging evil that the US does? Because lots of stuff that we participate in, like hiring mercenary groups in the Middle East, like Blackwater that kill lots of civilians, and stuff like supporting the IDF who kills lots of civilians in Palestine, and bombings in Yemen that kill lots of people, that gives support to the terrorist groups, that gives them the ability to recruit people who want to stop all the killing of their families and stuff. Is there anything that we're doing to acknowledge what we're doing to help the terrorist groups? Because that seems to be a main factor that's pushing them.
I don't believe, from the briefings that I've had, there really has not been any direct correlation between any actions by the United States, real or perceived, that would encourage or deter these terrorist groups. The terrorist groups believe that the United States is evil, that the United States should not exist. They have a different philosophy, a different mission, and really on the briefings that I have seen, there is nothing that has been shown that they would change their mission, their goal, if we stopped drone attacks that the president orders. So it, and with your question on the, does the United States do evil and bad things? People get killed. This is a dangerous world. We will see an attack on our homeland again. We saw it on 9/11. We will see it again. Will it be justified? No, it will not. We are a country that I believe stands for freedom, freedom for all of you to be here and express your opinions, freedom for me to express my opinions. You can't do that in many of these other countries. And we are looking after our interests, that is true, and that is my job as a United States Senator, to defend this country and provide for its security.
So lots of the people at the top of the terrorist groups, they will stick to that United States is evil thing, but the thing that I was focusing on was they're able to recruit moderates by lots of the positions that we're taking in helping kill civilians and stuff. That is a big recruitment factor for them.
I disagree with your statement on that, because I really go through a number of hearings and a number of briefings, classified briefings every week on this, and there have been no hard facts that show that. I know that you hear that out in social media and places, but I'm just being honest with you that there are no hard facts showing that they are able to recruit by that. They're very, very good at recruiting. They're very, very good at their use of social media. You know, we don't have any idea on what the rest of the world sees on that, but they're very good at that. They have to, I believe, with ISIL, they have to continue to gain territory, to take territory, because that is one of their big recruiting tools. We know that is one of their big tools, that they are able to reestablish the caliphate. That's what they use. And as long as they are able to continue to acquire territory, they will do it. And that's why you see them very, very active now in Northern Africa. I think I'm getting the sign one more.
Senator Fisher,
where are you?
I had a question regarding the letter that you co-signed that went to the Iranian leaders. What makes you think that was a good idea with regards to the agreement, to the talks that were going on? Yeah. And what made you decide to, you know, assign your name to that letter?
You know, signing that letter, I think it was a good idea. I'm glad I signed it. It clarified the position of the United States Senate. It in no way said that the Senate should be involved in negotiations. And I think there's a number of reasons for it. First of all, there's precedent for it. In 1979, I believe, Senator Robert Byrd went over to the Soviet Union to talk about the SALT II talks. He got involved in that. He went over to the Soviet Union. I know you've heard Nancy Pelosi went to Syria, talked to Assad, was asked not to during the negotiations there. So the Senate has been involved. There's a half a dozen cases where the senators have been involved. In fact, you know, they've been involved in the past to clarify the position of the Senate. I realize this isn't a treaty. This is an agreement. The Senate, though, has a duty, I believe, and a responsibility when we're talking about a nuclear program that can, in a very short period of time, a question of months, have a breakout to nuclear weapons, that we clarify that the Senate does have a responsibility there. Every nuclear treaty has been approved by the Senate. The Senate has to ratify those by the Constitution. So this is a nuclear program that could evolve into nuclear weapons. It's disheartening that the president hasn't kept the Senate involved in it. We've seen a bipartisan effort now to get the Senate involved. In fact, just a couple days ago, Senator Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, who will probably become the Democratic leader in a couple years when Harry Reid retires, he supports Congress, the Senate, having to approve this negotiated agreement. And what is left out many times is that the Congress established the sanctions. That was congressional action. So if you have something in this agreement with regards to the sanctions, it must take congressional action to change that. So the Senate should be involved. As elected representatives of the people, we should be updated on what's going on with negotiations by the administration instead of learning about it from second and third hand sources or from heads of state from other countries. So I signed the letter, and it was the right thing to do, I believe. So thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
For your timely perspectives on foreign policy. Do you still have time to meet with members of the media? Yes. Just a few minutes, perhaps. Please join me in thanking the Senator one more time for her time this afternoon.